we talk about the word abandonment, you know, part of that is that, again, abandonment is a deep fear. Abandonment means being left without love.
Yeah, I guess I didn't mean that. I meant
that's part of what I want to say. There's a difference in terms of the grieving process of being able to accept and letting go and the feeling of abandonment. See, a feeling of abandonment has to do with a lot of unresolved personal stuff. My expectation or my own personal attachment that I give to the child or to the other person, and it's a part of me that gets abandoned inside of myself. And that's a real fine line and a real difficult task to be aware of. There is grief and loss in any kind of letting go process. But again, that grief and loss is inside of myself. You know, for example, just the sense that I had of coming up here. Originally, when I came up here, the plan was my family was going to come with me, and they decided not to come. And on the one hand, I look at the advantages of having some time away, you know, and being in a different environment. On the other hand, I say to myself that there is still the daily routine and the part of loss that I feel for I'm not there, and the wonderment and the sense of not being able to. And I don't feel abandoned by them so much as I feel the loss of separation.
And what you're saying is that when you can work through these feelings, when separation is inevitability or whatever, whatever short term or whatever, that there's less that sense of abandonment.
Right. Yeah, abandonment is usually touched with a lot of fear. It's kind of, if they physically go away, the idea is that they are emotionally going away, that they don't like me anymore, or they don't care about me, or they won't want to be with me. If it's a separation that occurs on a, it's kind of, it wasn't my choice process that somebody else chooses to go away with me, there's a lot of rage and anger about being left without choice, kind of the helplessness and the powerlessness of being left. And that those are the feelings that are important for me to go through. Okay, I want to spend this session talking about kind of hope and healing and healthy parenting. And a part of it is in the phenomenon and the reality of being a parent. Again, because of all of the traditional and historical stuff I shared last night, there's a real lack of a sense of who I am and the being and the becoming of a parent that tends to interfere with knowing how to relate to a child. I want to share with you, there are kind of two specific aspects in terms of the responsibility of being a parent. One of them is to be a nurturer, that I am there with a responsibility to provide nurturing, care, safety. The second is discipline, that I am responsible to establish and set boundaries, to kind of provide a framework for a healthy, natural maturation and growth in the child's evolution, knowing that the child is dependent. And I want to share with you part of what I read in this book, Single Again. This chapter is on discipline, and it's called Spare the Rod and Spoil the Child. Okay, and I want you to hear some of the traditions so we begin to recognize that a lot of the typical behaviors that we are very familiar with, especially in terms of discipline, have a lot to do with traditional upbringing, traditional values. Discipline is defined in a lot of ways, and the most traditional form of discipline, or the way that discipline is often determined in our culture, is as punishment intended to correct or to train. In other words, the focus of discipline has often been a very preoccupation with a way of controlling behavior. So we've tended to look at a very, authoritarian perspective on seeing a parent as the person in control, and the child as a being that is second class and not responsible and not capable. And so the child being out of control needs to be controlled. And this is an ancient tradition. And I'm going to read just a short part of this book. It says, equating discipline with punishment is nothing new. An ancient Chinese lad, for example, who carelessly made a blot on his writing tablet was forced to drink a dish of ink. If his hand got into mischief, he received a sharp and agonizing whack over the palm. An old Egyptian proverb states that a boy's ears are on his back and he hears only when he is beaten. The Hebrew synagogue schools followed the proverbs, do not withhold discipline from a child. If you beat him with a rod, he will not die. During the Middle Ages, discipline was also severe. Monks had been taught that the body was an enemy of the soul, and it was to be punished. At one German monastery, all the boys were whipped regularly once a month just to be on the safe side. At an abbey in England, they were all flogged on Christmas Eve in order to make Christmas Day sweeter. In Thomas Schule, where Bach taught, each failure to obey a regulation resulted in some form of punishment. Famous New England primer used in American colonies included this verse, fear God all day, love Christ alway, parents obey in secret pray, no false things say, mind little play, by no sin stray, make no delay in doing good. In the 19th century, the birch rod still remained in American classrooms, and many Tom Sawyers felt the proverb, folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from home. In addition, whisperers had bits put in their mouths, restless squirmers had horses' blinders strapped to their temples, children who talked impertinently were forced to eat soap. Poor Tom Sawyer was both whipped and shamed for being tardy. Now go sit with the girls and let this be a lesson to you. In other words, part of what I want you to hear is that a lot of the tradition that still exists today and is alive and well is a tradition of abuse. It's in a parent-child relationship that the goal of the parent-child relationship is first to establish a sense of mutual respect. Meaning that we need to validate our humanness. That we as human beings are people first, and even these little beings are people, and that there is a sense of encouragement, nurturing, affirmation, unconditional acceptance that becomes the underlying gird for everything we do as people. We tend to forget, like for example, you've seen a lot of the PAT thing, that parent, adult, child phenomenon, transactional analysis kind of divides people into these things. And what happens is when a parent operates out of their parent role and tries to respond to a child, many times, and what they talk about in this kind of phenomenon is that if you have a critical parent, in other words, a parent that's pretty much focused on negativity and rules and the focus of discipline, that the implicit message given to the critical, from the critical parent to the child, and these right here, basically what you're dealing with here is beliefs, values, you know, right and wrong, ethics, morality. That's part of the parent part of ourselves. And the child is pretty much emotions. Emotions, spontaneity, and freedom. So the belief was that the person responsible for the beliefs and values was to respond to the child by learning, teaching the child how to control these spontaneous emotions. But in a system that is bent on criticism, on judgment, and putting the fear of God into people, that the dominant role tends to be one of a critical parent. Critical parent that tends to speak down to the child, and the implicit bottom line message is that what the child ultimately feels is not okay, is that I am unacceptable. The ultimate reality is that what we are moving toward in the parenting, part of this letting go process, is that a parent is to take a sense of responsibility to move toward exposing the sense of their adult, and the child is to learn to move toward learning so that there is a relationship of mutuality. That's the goal of parenting. That when we literally get to this level, the more the child is able to assume that semblance of self and responsibility, that the parent decreases while the child increases. But you can see what tends to happen here is that if this parent, a critical parent, takes control, the child never increases. Usually what happens is the child either begins to decrease, or what begins to happen is that the child then gets caught in a rebellious conflict and fights back. So this is what you begin to see, for example, in families and schools. If children think you're a bunch of hypocrites, it's okay. If this is the way it is, I'm not going to learn the values of life in terms of what's good for me. What I'm going to do is beat the system. I'm going to find ways to get around you. So the child is not learning a sense of self. Rather, what a child is learning is you've got control, and I've got to find a way to get my needs met around you. So what the child learns is deceit. The child learns only to be reactive to the parent. So I'll do whatever I do. The child learns a sense of separation, a sense of disconnectedness, that I don't belong to you and we don't necessarily respect each other. We're just embroiled in this conflict. And so eventually what happens is the child only learns more sophisticated means of arbitrarily manipulating the situation or how to get around people. And you win a few and you lose a few. And the goal in life is to win more than you lose. No sense of respect, mutual respect, no sense of nurturing and adoration, more just the deep abiding sense of this is a competition and there are good guys and bad guys in this competition. Now what do you think will happen to this child when this child grows into adulthood? What do you think this... Yeah, what ultimately happens is that the vengeance and the conflict here is that this child will ultimately learn to be the same critical parent. and eventually will have offspring of their own that they will play the same battle with from the other point of view. It's the state in our military, it's the state in our corporate rise to the top structure, all of our institutions. For many ways, it's the state of the institution of the church. There are those who have God and who are ordained, and you know, and that's why the radical transformation that has begun to happen in church, in terms of seeing the people of God as the central, and that the ministers are servants, is that we have taken the hierarchical thing and literally turned it upside down, and we've changed the hierarchy to more of a circular type of process, because it's only here and on this level that we can learn the art of mutual respect.
Going back to the historical precedent of being a patriarchal societies, this one or another society, the patriarchy is a matter of what, not necessarily dismantling, but, or is it? I mean, that's a question to ask.
Well, I think it's more than dismantling. I think there's some benefits and value in it, but the point is that oven by itself, it has become insensitive. It's non-community oriented. So what happens is that it needs to be transformed.
That transforms the word to operate.
It needs to be transformed, and that's a part of, like in the Catholic tradition, the Second Vatican Council was a primary transition point of changing the focus of church from the hierarchical structure, you know, to more of the people of God and the celebration of the people of God. And it's literally, you know, I mean, it's a slow transition, but even the churches, rather than seeing these Gothic, you know, male phallic buildings that are built with their high dome ceilings and the pulpits and the altars way up there, out there in the congregation, that many of the new buildings are now multi-purpose facilities that are built in the round, so that the celebration and the Eucharist is done in the center as opposed to up above, and that the community is now more included in the Eucharistic celebration as opposed to it being in a foreign language, and that the, you know, the celebrant stands before the people and celebrates back to the people. So there are lots of different ways that that's being symbolized in terms of transformation. But I want you to see how this kind of process and the old traditional process and a lot of those values or rules that I read about discipline perpetuate themselves in the cycle, and that we never really learn to mature into our adult. And the core of the being the adult is that I am able, with my own reflexive consciousness, to see the value and to make choices based on respect for myself, respect for others, respect for the community and the world at large. The way we begin to transform this thing to a healthier process has first to do with modeling behavior. A healthy parent is a parent who can model healthy humanity. Again, reflect back to all that we've started with in terms of self-care and being who I am. Now what this means is, in terms of modeling, is that I am human first. And what that means in terms of breaking the expectations and traditions of parenting is that we need to let go of the obligation and responsibility of doing it right. There is no such thing. As human beings, we have the right to fail and make mistakes and be inaccurate. I can share with you an example in terms of like being a counselor. You know, that I've been doing a lot of counseling and have pretty good reputation. A lot of people come and see me. And I was involved in this, you know, had this gal who'd been coming in for counseling for a long time. And I, one day there was something that had gone on, some kind of tragedy in my life. And I was there counseling, and I shouldn't have been. But I started her into this guided fantasy. And, you know, we were going to do this intense, you know, semi-hypnotic trance state, and doing some guided fantasy work. And I got her into the middle of it, and then I got distracted and I got lost. And I had to stop the session, and I had to kind of bring her out of it and just say, look, I'm really out of it today. I need to stop this and let go. And I was just really apologizing all over the place and feeling like an inadequate fool and everything else. And I says, well, you know, maybe we could get together next week. And I thought to myself, well, I'll probably never see her again, you know, because as a professional, I really screwed up. And what happened was, she came back for her appointment the next week, and she came in and she sat down, and she had this big smile on her face. She says, I want you to know, last week was the best session we ever had.
Did you charge
for it? Yeah, of course. No. No, but part of what she said was, she says, you know, I've always been in awe of you and your skills, but I always felt somewhat distant and separated from you because you seemed so up there on a pedestal. And last week you fell off your pedestal. And she says, you know, I feel closer to you, that I experienced your humanness. And it makes me value your skills all the more, but it also gives me a sense of hope that I'm okay as a person because I can see you as a person. Okay? And that's something that parents often neglect and don't recognize, that it's important for children to see us as people. I used to do in the Catholic schools, I used to teach the religious education part of their class. And so I would always go in and do a values clarification. And of course, what they wanted to talk about was drugs and sex. And of course, that was their first issue. And I would always ask them about, if they wanted to talk about sex, I says, well, how many of you think that your parents have sex? And most of them would say, oh, yeah. God, that's disgusting. You know. And a part of it is that in some ways there's a sadness, because a part of the denial in our culture is that many times we as parents or as people, we tend to, if we feel the obligation and responsibility as parents, forget that we are modeling to them who we are as human beings. And the need to be passionate, and the need to be human, and the need to have our own wants and desires, and our own needs, and our fantasies, and our playfulness, and our insanity, and, you know, that all of those things are part of what modeling being a human being. Parents often get caught up, especially when we separate ourselves from our humanness, is that we often get caught up in the reality of assuming that to be a model means to be the perfect parent. So we get preoccupied with setting out the rules and telling them all the rights and wrongs, and this is what this is, and we get preoccupied with criticizing them. And what happens is we don't share our humanity with them. And children love that humanity. Children love knowing that parents screw up too. It gives them a sense of hope. See, because if we are these perfect idols and images up here, see, then the child always feels inadequate. It's like I could never measure up. And most of the time we're giving them an illusion in the first place, because we can't even live up to those standards. You know, we sabotage ourselves all the time. And kids know that. That's why kids keep saying, well, adults are all hypocrites, you know, because they keep telling us that we got to do these things. But in reality, you know, and I can share that in a personal experience. For example, my wife and I at one point, we came home from a trip and we drove all night, which was really silly. And when we got home, place was a mess, and she was real chaotic, and we got into this huge fight together right in front of the kids, and our little boy was just scared because he had never seen us really fight that much, where we were yelling and screaming at each other, and we were just really out of control, and you know, and then we didn't talk to each other for a while, you know. So I felt horrible because here was this little kid that was kind of running back and forth between mommy and daddy, and of course the older kids were saying, "Well, are you guys going to get a divorce?" You know, they're just real concrete and logical. Well, they had a fight. That's it. You know, the party's over. And a part of what came out of that whole experience, eventually, you know, it's like we talked out some of that stuff, and as we talked out that stuff, we went out and talked with the kids, and we talked about how inappropriate we were to each other in not dealing with ourselves, that we were unrealistic in driving, we were too tired, and we never should have done that. And, you know, and I accepted responsibility for the ways that I was out of control, and my wife did, and then we talked about with them ways of doing anger. Okay, and so what we learned, and we talked about ways of protecting from anger. In other words, we talked with the little boy about saying if somebody else is angry and you don't want to listen to it, you can press this little magic button in your hand, and the shield will come down around you, and you can let them yell and scream all they want, and you don't have to take any, it'll just bounce off your little magic shield. He loves it. You know, he loves that little concept. And then we talked about, and that's when we got out the rackets and bats and said, what we need to do is when we're really angry, go in and work on our anger. And so we had each of the kids go in and practice on the bit. Say that, and this is kind of, it's funny to watch it, but it's really valuable. Is to talk about, when you get on the bed, you can swing as hard as you want. You know, you have to be safe and make sure you're not going to hurt anything. But swing as hard as you want, and you can say anything you want. And the little kid looks up, you know, our little 7-year-old looks up at us and says, "Is it all right if I swear?" You know, and say, "Well, as long as you're sitting on the bed and you're doing anger work, you can say anything you want." And I just was amazed because I had never heard this from my 7-year-old. But he sat on there saying, "This fucking thing," and he started beating this racket. And my wife and I looked at each other. We both just kind of went, "Whoa." He doesn't know how to talk like this. You know? But in reality, you know, it's like, see, they know it's all there. And what we did was say, we're not trying to deny that anger is not a part of reality, but it's a way of saying, if you organize it and structure it in a way that it's not damaging, it's very acceptable. And it's amazing the number of times we've come home or things have happened, like the kids will be fighting and one of them will say, "Well, you know, Jeremy needs to go do some anger work." You know, see that they sense that there's an alternative to their conflicting with each other. They recognize the capacity, and they have a permission. And that sometimes that if we lock ourselves away and or if we're upset, you know, it's like, "I'm gonna go be by myself." You know, and the little one will say, "Well, do you need to go do some anger work?" And yeah, "I'm gonna go do some anger work. I'm gonna do some good stuff." So it's like they see the emotional conflict but don't feel overwhelmed and intimidated by it, because there's an open way to communicate that there's a healthy structure, that we know how to do the grief. And that we teach them that there are ways of safe places to go do that stuff. And the point of it all is that it isn't just a punishment, it's a form of discipline. And that it's universal, meaning that we do the same things as adults.
I'd like to say I take heart from myself in knowing that it's really okay to blow it.
Yeah.
Because I can have all the rules and all the right things to do and say, "Well, you know, you work out your anger this way, you do all these things to get through it." But sometimes it seems real healthy to just do it all wrong and to blow it and be at the bottom and say, "God, I really made a mess." And go through what you did with, you know, yelling at your wife and having to make up and look at, well, we aren't all these people.
right.
So there is validity in just what?
Sure. And the kids, see, it's like kids feel this long before we admit it. We tend to think as parents that, well, you know, this is all going on, but we don't want the kids to know about it. So we keep a stiff upper lip, or we go on and pretend stuff. And it's like the kids know when there's tenseness in the house. You know, they know, and it's like, oh God, Mom and Dad are at it again, you know. You know, it's like you're trying to sit there and be the super responsible parent, but they can tell you're ready to burst out in tears. It's just kind of what you're saying. Your daughter comes up to you and says, how can I take your sadness away? You know, you may not have even had a visual expression of sadness, but they know it. Kids are very clear. They're more feeling people than they are thinking people, so that they have that extra sensitivity. And a lot of our illusion as parents is the illusion that if we just, when we're around the kids, that we're together and we're logical and we're responsive and responsible and we're doing all that stuff, and they know if we're sad or depressed, and they know if we're mad about stuff, and they know if things are uneasy. And that what we communicate to them is that stuff your feelings down. Stick yourself in your grief. What we also communicate to them is a sense of disrespect. If we make the kids believe that it's not okay for them to see our humanness. Now that's different from making them responsible for our grief. Kids are not capable of resolving our grief. So it's not to take our grief to kids so that they fix it for us. They're not capable of doing that. But it's important for them to know that we grieve, that we have a right to our grief. And that it's real affirmation for them to know on a human level that we respect them enough that to be willing to share with it and not hide with them. Honesty is an essential component of modeling healthy parenting. Be upfront with the kids. Kids can handle it. Again, in our fear, part of our frozen grief is we don't want the kids to know. And the kids have known for years. You know, they know what's going on. Don't pretend. Especially if you're in a divorce or widowed or separated or lost, you know, to try to carry on the illusion inside of yourself that I'm not affected by this situation or by this relationship. It's all a lie. They know. They feel the subtleness. They can go from one parent to the next and know what's going on and where the tensions are, the little subtle languages, the ways we try to check things out with each other. And if we try to hold all that back, it's a real discount to them. It's a real sense of disrespect for them, and they begin to feel that sense of separation and isolation. So be clear and upfront. And it doesn't mean that things need to be resolved. You know, that's one of the other things, is that parents have a tendency to say, well, I'm only going to talk about things when I've got a solution to it all. Instead of just being able to say, I'm sad and I need to feel my sadness, you know, and that I'll live through my sadness. I don't know what I'm going to do with it right now.
Yeah. Something just struck me. As an educator, as a teacher, I don't know whether it's something internal or whether it's society or whatever, I don't know. That we must be right all. We've got all the answers. We're supposed to be teachers. Right. And yeah, and that there's kind of a divided thing there, because I'm also learner too. I mean, that's the central part of the teaching, but I don't know. I'm going to have to sort that out.
I think if you use the word facilitator, then it's a little better, because you facilitate and you help a lot. I always like that word instead of the word teacher.
Mm-hmm. I like that word too. Yeah.
Just a different word than it maybe makes sense.
Facilitator, we've gone from a thing world to a process world. As we understand energy and process, we recognize that what we are about is simply being models of a healthy process. And that's why the word facilitator fits better, that what we are modeling is the process of humanity. So if we are choosing to be Christian or Christ-like or loving or compassionate, we need to facilitate compassion by living compassion. Okay, that means living it in our own lives and then being able to extend it to other process. But the process itself is much bigger than our own. That's where the humility comes in. It's not like I'm the one who understands the right way to parent. It's more like learning what the process of effective parenting is about and seeing what it is that I can provide in that uniqueness. Now there's another big part of this. And this is a part of the role of parent. In other words, I am human. If I am a parent, that means I have taken on a responsibility. Means I've taken on a discipline, a commitment, and an obligation. Parenting is a job, just like being a plumber is a job, or being a teacher is a job. It's a responsibility, and it has with it a set level of obligations, characteristics about what it is that I do. And that's different from my humanity. And one of the most difficult things about parents is that parents often can't accept and can't separate. And one of the ways we discount ourselves as parents or as human beings is when we get so caught up in being a wife or a mother or a father or a lover or a friend. And we get so preoccupied with those roles that we lose our own humanity. We lose our separateness. This is an obligation and a responsibility. And I split the word responsibility into the way that I shared before in the sexuality thing, because I think that this is something important. If I am to be a parent, it means that I need to learn my job. Parenting is not something that comes naturally. I may have absorbed a lot of things if I had the healthy experience of a parent of my own that modeled things. I may have internalized a lot of those attitudes and behaviors. But it's still a responsibility, and at every age of that child's development, I have to learn new ways of responding because their ages and stages of development are different. And so my responsibility as a parent becomes different at those different ages. And it becomes real essential that I look on that as a responsibility for myself as a person. In terms of one of the roles of parent, it's as a disciplinarian. And this is a way of saying we can have mutual respect in terms of a parent and a child for us as human beings and raise each other to the same level of acceptance. But we have different roles. And my role as a disciplinarian is to establish boundaries. To set the primary rules and structure of the home or of the house. We are responsible for negotiations. In other words, parents are the ones who respond or decide at what point we involve the children in the negotiations to set rules and expectations. In other words, we decide what's negotiable and what's not negotiable. In terms of the parent household, it's important to know that the parent accepts their adult responsibility. It's my house because I pay the bills for it, and that you are welcome and very much a part of this house, But there are certain things that you cannot do as children. Like, you can't go out and live in the world on your own. You don't buy and pay for all of this stuff. So you need to learn respect for me. And a part of a child learning respect for a parent is a parent to be clear on the boundaries of what is my obligation and my responsibility and what is yours. So a part of then in the negotiation is that in doing boundaries that we set out the clarity of roles of what is my parent responsibility and what is your child responsibility. And then we negotiate out the behaviors. How do we accomplish these goals? So that the children can be clear in terms of what they can expect from you. And you can be clear with the children about what you expect from them. Now, the core of discipline. Discipline means, you know, comes from the word disciple. The core of discipline is simply to ritualize and to learn the boundaries or to learn how to function within a certain maxim or a certain social unit. In order for them to negotiate specific behaviors, then the next part of this is, what are the consequences for the violation of boundaries? In other words, if we have certain behaviors that are expected and have been negotiated, then what are the consequences for those? And the core is to recognize is that it is the parent role to give out consequences. It's the child's responsibility to live it. Now, I'm going to spend a lot more time in this, but I want you to see that this is a part of the integral difference between punishment and the teaching of discipline. Punishment is an act that's usually associated with a level of rage or anger or grief. And punishment is doled out as a way to control or manipulate behavior. So the focus is control in punishment. In discipline, it's to teach responsibility. So what it requires is clarity, consistency. See, child development teaches us that children will internalize things when they are done consistently, and that children need to experience things 30 to 40 to 50 times before it becomes an internalized value. See, we learn habitually, and the way we learn habitually is by repeated patterns. In order for that habit to be internalized with a sense of wellness, that habit has to be repeated with a sense of consistency. The other part of it is separating our emotions and our grief from the consequences and the behavior. If a discipline is doled out of anger or rage, see, then it doesn't become a form of a teaching behavior, a natural consequence to a behavior or a broken, agreed upon contract. Instead, what it does is it becomes the vengeance of somebody's rage and anger. So the child doesn't learn anything other than when so-and-so gets really mad, watch out. So they don't learn about responsibility for their own behavior and consequences for their own choices. Rather, what they learn is watch for the mood of mom or dad. You know, and adapt my behavior to the mood of mom or dad. So this is one of the things. Remember I talked before in terms of detachment about learning the difference between the person and the behavior in terms of communicating feeling. A parent's role is to set boundaries and limits. Part of negotiation is set limits on behavior. In other words, it's important to negotiate out clearly what is acceptable and what is not acceptable behavior. And what are the consequences that should come if that behavior is not followed through on. The tendency often is that punishments or disciplines often are very irrational or illogical. You know, for example, somebody comes home a half an hour late, so they're grounded for 6 months. It's kind of an illogical, irrational reaction to a particular behavior. Somebody breaks a glass and they get slapped across the mouth or spills their milk on the table. Okay. In other words, a part of what we need to do is recognize with a deep sense of reason the difference between what is normal human behavior and what is a violation of limits. And what that means is that parents themselves have to be clear on their own values. Clear on your own values, beliefs, and rules of the house. Clear on defining what's my territory, what's my stuff, what's my responsibility. Unfortunately, a lot of times, discipline is doled out arbitrarily. You know, it's kind of, when I'm feeling good, do whatever you want to do, but when I'm real uptight, watch out. Don't get in my way. And what that teaches to kids is not a sense of responsibility, it's more a sense of a preoccupation with checking out what kind of mood I'm in. Because I know I can ask you for this stuff when you're feeling this way, but if I get this kind of sense, then watch out. And so again, they don't learn a sense of self-respect and self-discipline. Rather, what they do is learn how to be more codependent with me, how to adjust and adapt their personality according to how I express myself. The key to this is that when I establish a clear sense of value, structure, and belief about myself, then what I am also saying to those children is that I will live by these standards also. That I won't make you do anything that I don't believe in and don't do myself. Now there are certain things, for example, like drinking, that you may have rules about that have to do with kind of a age difference. I am an adult, and as an adult, I have this freedom. So what we teach children is the sense of the rites of passage. When you get to this particular age, you will have, and we talked a little bit yesterday about, you know, driving cars and, you know, and wanting to get licenses, that has to be a discipline that's set. Well, it's a law first. You can't do it until you get to the age of 16. But it also becomes a part of the rite of passage in the family. And that we need to live out these things. And a part of the hypocrisy is if we are parents, if we are out of control in our own behavior and our own lives, see, then we are literally immobilized because we have completely discounted our respect. Children won't respect a parent who's out of control with himself. They may fear them, but they are completely ineffective. We need to set clear boundaries and limits about touch, anger, what's healthy, what's not healthy. clear boundaries about sex, what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. Clear and healthy boundaries about territory or possessions. See, what this gets into is the things that, for example, many parents will say, well, my kid never cleans his room. It always looks like a dump. You know, and parents get just obsessed and upset because the kid has got toys everywhere or clothes on the floor, or all the drawers are pulled out and the bed's never made. See, and what happens is oftentimes parents will project their own obsession or their own fears into that child's world. It's important for children to have a space where they can go be messy, kind of their own place where they can be as chaotic as they want to be. And that we set the boundary that there may be certain things in terms of common lived space that we have clear and established boundaries in self-care. But it's also important to know that there may be places and spaces that is your stuff. And you do whatever you want to do in that stuff. You may set some limits and boundaries around that, is that it needs to be cleaned, you know, on a periodic basis in your time frame, because, you know, we have to guard against disease. We have to guard against mold, you know. You know, and I can't go out and buy clothes because all of yours are on a dirty heap in the floor all the time. You know, so we have to negotiate those kind of clear boundaries and limits with him. But the key beyond that is that there is a sense of mutual respect in terms of setting limits, though, that you have a privilege to do that, but whenever you come in a common lived space, there are obligations and responsibility. And there is a difference between this is your stuff and what you choose to do with it is up to you, but this is my stuff. And there are obligations in terms of we all live in this household together, so we have a shared responsibility, and especially in the circumstance of divorce and separation, where a parent, spends more time out of the home and there are more things that need to be done, it's important that the young people recognize that a part of redefining the boundaries of our household is that we have less people to take care of all of the needs of this, and that they can take a share of the responsibility, and that it is a sense of injustice on their part if they refuse to or try to assume that, well, you should do it, you're the parent. You know, that's a part of unreasonableness. Basically, what we're talking about is getting down to just what is natural, logical, and reasonable. If we can use our own sense of logic and reason in terms of setting boundaries, then what? Yeah, go ahead.
I got a question there, though. I mean, it takes a lot of wisdom to decide a growing child has the ability to also reason as well as to live by emotions. I mean, how do you enforce how do you establish, when you establish certain discipline standards that are supposed to be agreed upon, what happens when those are not followed? I mean,
exactly. Okay, good. Take me right into the next part. Just as parents are responsible for establishing boundaries and limits and giving out consequences, children are responsible. The child's responsibility is to live with the consequences. In other words, the way you teach responsibility to children is to say, I have a responsibility as parent, and that you are still living under my house, and that there are a lot of obligations that happen here, and I will give you choices. The choices are we sit down and negotiate out the rules. There are some that are negotiable, there are some that are non-negotiable. If you choose to violate these things, and we understand that the child needs to be put in the context of a choice. A child always has a choice to comply with the boundaries and limits or to not comply. And that then at that point, it's that the child either will get praise affirmation, you know, still needs praise affirmation for their willingness to be responsible and living according to the limits, or the child will experience consequences. And the consequences are the child's responsibility. In other words, the way you feed the information back to the young person is a way of saying, you had a choice. Here was what we agreed upon. You had a choice. You chose to violate that boundary or limit. It is my obligation as parent, according to our agreement and negotiations, that you will have to live with these consequences. So that the child learns that it is their responsibility and that is their choice, that if they choose to violate boundaries, they will choose to also take on a vast array of consequences for their behavior.
I was just going to say, along with that, I found that I think kids have a sense of responsibility. They really take a lot of pride in that. And that whole game of testing sometimes is part of that. And they want to test you. And if you don't live up to your role as the one to give the kind of the consequences, they find you to be a hypocrite.
Right.
And I think that's a real, and then they have a sense of insecurity too.
You bet. That's the sense of mutual respect, is that a parent still has a deep sense of responsibility, because when these behaviors come, a parent still has the responsibility to enforce consequences. It's the child's responsibility to choose whatever direction they want and to live with whatever consequences come from their choices, so that they learn that they are responsible for their choices and behavior, but there are still clear boundaries, and that when a child chooses to violate the boundaries of that, and see, what you are now beginning to teach them in this kind of process is that you are teaching them an adult-adult responsibility. That in the real world outside, you know, there are people who have certain boundaries and limits, and if you choose to violate those limits, that there are very stringent consequences, whether that's with the law, or whether or not you work in a certain place, or whether you're accepted by community, or in other words, this is the natural bent of human beings, is that there's a learning of mutual respect and learning to respect the boundaries of others, and parents can role model that by accepting that responsibility for these young people. But again, it requires a sense of consistency and willingness. Now, the key to working on consequences is that consequences should be logical or natural. In other words, it's rather than trying to figure up arbitrary consequences or punishments, it's making things kind of basically fairly logical, so that the consequence fits the behavior. And many times what happens is, in our punishment mode, is that we get real reactive, and so what we want to do is a kid violates a curfew and we're mad enough to say, well, I'm not going to buy you this thing that I was going to buy you. You know, and like something like a promise that was made before has nothing to do necessarily with curfew. Curfew has more to do with trusting and respecting limits and behavior. and there are consequences that are more consistent with curfew violations or more logical with curfew violations than trying to take away something else. So it's a way of saying, and this is where ownership of my own feelings, I need to know as a parent, because I am responsible for you, that you have a sense of responsibility, and so my willingness to give you privileges or allow you freedoms or to take you places will depend upon your willingness to respond responsibly. So we set these boundaries in curfews. If you choose to violate those curfews, it makes me angry and I get scared about your safety inside, so I am not willing to extend these privileges. That may mean I change the curfews. It may mean that I am unwilling to provide transportation. I am unwilling to allow or to give you the money or the resources to do other things until you show me a sign of your willingness to be responsible, so that the consequence fits the violation itself. If it's something like they're supposed to do the dishes and they refuse to do the dishes, you know, a part of that is to say, rather than the anger of, well, go to bed right now. And going to their room and going to bed has nothing to do necessarily with the dishes, because for many of them they're saying, great, you know, I'm glad to get out of here. I don't want to deal with this. The point of it is to say that, well, until these dishes are met and you leave the dishes in the sink, you know, until these dishes can be respected and clean, I guess, until you're willing to do those things, then there is no more food available to you. So there are no more snacks, and you are not welcome to use anything else, and if you are going to eat, you're going to have to use your own dirty dishes. You may not use anything else that's clean. Okay, so let them experience the natural consequence, you know, of their own unwillingness to take responsibility. If it's dirty clothes all over the place, it's a way of saying, well, if you run out of clothes, you run out of clothes. So you either have to go to school without them, or you have to put on the old dirty ones and live with it. You know, if they abuse the hair dryer or if they do stuff, you know, it's just like, well, I'll take the hair dryer for today and you'll have to go to school without your hair blown dry, and maybe you can try again tomorrow. The key to consequences, in order for them to be logical and natural, is that they have to fit the situation. And secondly, they have to be time limited. And a part of being time limited means that it doesn't do any good to, whenever a kid does something, get so mad and ground them for life. I remember hearing that a few times. And that's it. You'll never be able to go out and do this again, you know. You know, and understand that, you know, extended periods of time, consequences over extended periods of time for a kid that tends to be preoccupied in a day-to-day living type of situation, that for a kid to be preoccupied in a day-to-day living situation, you know, a week, 2 weeks, a month is an eternity. And what happens is, at that point, many times what they do is simply say, well, screw it, you know, I screwed up and there's no chance. And so they give up. They don't learn anything or take any responsibility for it. They just kind of say, oh, well.
Plus, you can't enforce grounding for life.
That's, yeah.
You doubt your party.
Yeah.
It's an infliction upon yourself.
That's right. That's exactly it. And we do that, and then there's the reality of enforcing it. And this is where a lot of kids learn, is like parents, yeah, well, they'll say things, but I know that if I just keep quiet for a day or so, my mom will forget it, and then the next thing I know, I'm out doing whatever it is that I was going to do. So kids learn ways to get around. So part of putting a time limit is for your own, it's for your own sanity too, that because what's important for the kids to learn is that doing consequences for them is as much work for you as it is for them. It's not natural for us to want to deprive or to take away or to limit consequences. But they still need to learn responsibility for their consequences. The third part of this is that, again, we need to separate behavior from the person. I can love you, but I can be mad as hell at what you're doing. And if what you're doing is breaking the contract or what we have negotiated, then there will be consequences, and the consequences will be time-linked according to when you're willing to change your behavior. What that does is it doesn't attack the integrity of that person as a being, but rather it challenges that young person to say, you have choices and your behavior can easily be changed. It's up to you. If you choose to be rebellious and not change, then you choose the same consequences. And so you follow through consistently. Allow them to experience the pain of separation and accept the responsibility for that separation. It's perfectly acceptable for young people to have limits set on them. They don't like it, good. That means it's effective, you know.
I just added, I think that consistency really gives them a sense of security.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
And then that builds the trust.
Sure. And I hear that perpetually from kids, that like kids that come in for chemical dependency treatment, they've been out in the street, they've been prostituting, they've been using, selling dopes, and the basic thing is when they get down to their deepest level of catharsis is that, you know, why weren't you angry at me? Why didn't you be angry at me and tell me how you felt all along? It doesn't make the parents responsible for what those kids chose to do. But it is a sense of they are missing the sense of consistency and stability.
Because I'm finding it real hard right now. There are some behaviors that I want to be different, behaviors that have been going on for a long time because they came out of the relationship of struggle and strife that my husband and I were in. But now that we're separated and I'm on my own, now I guess I had a fantasy that those behaviors would disappear, right? The circumstances were different. They haven't disappeared, and my encouraging and suggesting things that would make them different have just been met with, you know, heels buried into the ground, and it's like, it's a heck of a lot more work than I ever realized to go about changing things that I don't like in the way my children do things or the way that we do things together or don't do things together. And the process, I guess, is a lot longer are more arduous than I ever imagined. Part of me just goes, oh, geez, I guess it's never going to be any different than what it was. But I still have some hope that maybe eventually it will be different. The goals or the sense of what I want to be different to. But sometimes need encouragement or just to say, God, it's really hard. I thought it would all change overnight.
Oh, I was just going to piggyback on what Margaret said about consequences. I think that when a child has gone through that consequence, it's also a chance of them being able to go through that transformation and make things right, and they're done it, now I'm not going to do that again. It's a chance for them to kind of save face and change.
I was just going to say with the process of the behavior, I'm not sure that this is what I think that has to be going on, is that you sort of have to unlearn behavior and then relearn new behavior, and that's all a long process.
Now, one of the things that becomes important, especially in the single parent family, is the recognition that the only thing that you have power over is your domain. Meaning that what a child does with a separated or ex-spouse or with friends is outside of the realm of your possibility. For us to try to parent what goes on with a child and their behavior is irrational. And we can drive ourselves absolutely nuts. What a child needs is to know the consistency of what can be expected when you live in my domain and are in direct relationship with me or experience anything that is a natural consequence with me. But for parents to try to legislate how a child behaves outside of the home is to really set yourself up for sabotage, that it virtually becomes impossible to legislate a child's behavior outside of your own domain. You can share feelings around that, but if a child goes to a rock concert, you don't have any necessary say about what they choose to do at a rock concert, or if they're out there with their boyfriend or girlfriend and it's their date in a car and you're concerned about whether or not they're going to have sex or not. Okay? You don't have any control over those kind of choices. Part of separating, you may have feelings, and especially if there is an ex-spouse who's treating the child differently, you know, you may have lots of feelings about the way the child's being treated differently and how that comes home. It's important to remind the child that when you're here, this is the way that things happen here. And I may have feelings and I need to own those feelings about what's going on differently out there, but I am not responsible. And this is one of the most difficult things that happens in divorce and separation, because many times parents carry their unresolved resentments through the children, okay, and sabotage each other. By, I don't agree with such and so, so I'm going to treat you this way. It's a way of getting back. And eventually what often happens in that phenomenon is that kids learn that they can get what they want by playing the parents against each other. If we can get them real pissed off at each other, then they both become immobilized and we basically do whatever it is that we want to do.
I knew that.
Yes, yes.
Another thing is the process that balance what's for outside the domain, what's the appropriate way for, say, a child, for your son to treat other people, what's appropriate to set consequences for that, or?
It's appropriate for you to teach that in terms of them understanding your value. It's not appropriate for you to try to legislate that.
What's the difference between legislating and setting consequences for inappropriate behavior?
Well, see, you can't set consequences for inappropriate behavior outside of the domain. The only way you can deal with that, see, for example, it's the way that I said, say with the kids, with my kids, is that just as you have to learn to be responsible here, I don't know what you're going to do at school. But the one thing that I want you to hear is that if you violate some of the rules at school, then I am not going to go in there and argue for you and get you off. I'm going to tell the school to give you the full consequence. If you get busted by the law, I'm not going to come down and bail you out. I'm going to have them keep you there over the weekend.
I'm just trying to think from a child's perspective. If I add so much that it's not appropriate for you to hit me or hit your brother at home, and if they're out in their next door neighbor's yard and they hit their next door neighbor, I feel, don't I have a responsibility to tell them what the negative consequences of him is? From a child's perspective, that would be inconsistent. That at home, I have the kid has negative consequences hitting somebody, but the next door neighbor, you know, what do you do with that?
Part of it is all you can do is share your feelings with them. You can share feelings of disapproval. You can allow them to experience the consequences because they may have gotten a crap knocked out of them. Or what may have happened is that the neighbor in their anger says you are no longer welcome in this domain, and allow them to experience their own consequences with the environment outside of that. You can also share with them that I will not respect or not approve of that behavior of you. So I find no delight or satisfaction that you're out and doing that kind of behavior. And if it's a violation of crime, or if there are consequences in terms of vandalism of other people's property, you will bear the consequences of paying for that vandalism. If there's a medical bill from you hitting somebody else and they had to go to the emergency room, you will be responsible for doing that, and we'll work out ways. I mean, there are lots of alternatives, because a lot of kids can't pay for that stuff, you know, but they can be, there are consequences that you can give that you are responsible, but they still need to accept the consequences from that behavior and experience that. The best way is to talk with children about how does it feel? How does it feel for you to be involved with that out there? I can share my feelings with you, and if a child respects you and you're mad about something they do, your anger has an impact, because they know that they have your disapproval. See, but if you get out there and try to control a child's behavior in an environment outside of yourself, you're really setting yourself up. Because then what happens is the child doesn't take any responsibility for their behavior. What they do is play a game with how much they can get away with around you. And you end up finding yourself pulling your hair out because you're trying to legislate things that you're powerless over.
I think another issue that I'm thinking about beyond, other than behavior, is values. Values are more basic of who we are and what we believe in. In some ways, that's a little harder for me, is that my set of values are very different from what my husband's set of values are. And part of me has some fear of what the children really will have, or do have, two sets of values that are very different. And I think that they probably clearly understand that these come from me and those come from him.
See, and that's the only way that you can do that. If you get into a conflict of values of who's right or wrong, good or bad, you really set yourself up for a war.
Well,
you cannot legislate values for children.
Yeah,
that's really hard for people to accept, that they cannot legislate values, that the world is a world filled with different values and different beliefs, and children need to learn the art of discernment. If I can be consistent with who I am and be clear and give feedback, but allow the child the responsibility of choosing, then they have to face their own consequences out there. But if I am perpetually trying to protect, or perpetually trying to control, or if I am righteously condemning other kinds of values out there, what I am doing is putting my own fear and my own need on them. And I'm taking away the respect, and I'm taking away their ability and right to make that determination for themselves.
I think a lot more trust as a parent comes into play here. Trusting that even if they are exposed to very different values, that they will in fact find for themselves value out of it.
Exactly.
I was just sitting in my bed and Mark's question about that. The experience that I've had with teaching is that you, like you said, can't always control all of the situations there in and outside your domain. And sometimes they'll find their own consequences, and sometimes they will get by with things, like for instance, hitting the kid. Maybe there wouldn't be any immediate consequence that time. I think one thing that parents can do always consistently is be role models. And so that's one way that it can help. And the other thing, too, with the idea of having a trust, like you said, I've found that kids who know that their parents aren't going to stick up for them in another domain, like in for me in the a school situation, those kids consistently felt better about themselves and their behavior, and they were more in control of their world because they didn't have someone else extremely trying to control it. And they also, I think, accepted responsibility and felt a lot felt better about themselves. Mm-hmm. And because they just knew they didn't have enough, so they had to rise to the occasion. Mm-hmm. And so it keeps them ordered in their own way. Okay. And so it's hard to let go of that, but it's, I've seen it time and time again, and it's so, it's just so consistent that to me it's a fact. Mm-hmm. And I've taught 9 years.
Scripturally, the word I would use, kind of the way that the Christian tradition has survived, and the basis of it is covenant. The covenant as opposed to contract. Covenant means fidelity. Yahweh had a covenant with the people. And if you consider the people as little children who down through the generations challenged Yahweh, went away from Yahweh, idol worship, got into all these wars, got into all this abusive and sexual behavior, and Yahweh was always there consistently. And it was the consistency of Yahweh, you know, that held the people together. And that's the value that you can bring as a parent. That if I have a solid foundation and a consistency for who I am, kids are going to be rebellious, they're going to bounce off the walls, they're going to challenge you to the hilt, they're going to go out and do the very things that they don't want you, or they know that you don't want them to do. They're going to do all of that stuff, but I have a sense of fidelity and consistency about my values, my belief, and my life. That when they come through that rebellious period and reach a sense of who am I, what am I, what do I value most in their life, what they are going to turn back to is the one who has been most consistent and stable in their lives. Not the one who's bounced off the walls with them. And that's what often happens when parents get so enmeshed and get insane and crazy with their kids. See, then the kids feel really insecure because I can't go talk to my parent. They're as crazy as I am. And they know that I'm crazy, and I know that I'm crazy. But if they're as crazy as I am, then I've got nowhere to go. And that's where a lot of insecurity is. So a part of the fidelity is the stability and consistency of who I am as a person. It's setting my boundaries and my limits for myself as a person. It's legislating what I can do in my house. And it's also giving the child responsibility for their behavior. I provide for you services and things, but the older you grow, the more responsibility you have for your choices. They are your consequences. If you use chemicals, it's your choice. If you become chemically addicted, it's your disease. I'm angry at the disease. I may be willing to support you, but I'm not willing to support your diseased behavior. If you choose to be a violent and angry person, it's your choice. It's your behavior. It's your consequences. I don't take responsibility for your anger. I don't support your anger. Matter of fact, I may have some strong consequences for your anger. If you choose to break the rules, it's your choice. Regardless of how angry a child can be, it doesn't mean that they have a right to violate somebody else's property or position. They have a right to their anger, and they need to learn a healthy expression to their anger, but they don't have a right to violate my boundaries or my rules. See, and that's a part of separation from person to behavior. I can love you, and I can acknowledge your feelings and willing to support and nurture your growth and your grief. I am not willing to support a agitated, compulsive, addictive, abusive, self-destructive behavior, and that we need to respond to that behavior. Now, one of the ways that we begin to deal with this, and part of a way, you know, we're talking a lot about rules and consequences and negotiation, but one of the things that's important to understand in all of this process, and this is one of the sad things, it doesn't happen very often, but part of the consistency is consistency of communication. Now, what that can mean is that it's important for a family to be up front and communicate. Remember that children have short-term memory spans, okay. Meaning they live in the present, and that you can't just say one thing and 2 years later expect them to still have remembered that kind of thing. That everything has to be negotiated. Clarity of communication and consistency means that things need to be communicated. So it often means that one of the healthy structures is that we have to have family meetings. And part of what I liken to family meetings is the sense that, you know what I mean, it's like our kids. Every time we say, well, we're going to have a family meeting, they always say, oh, God. I don't want to do this. Yeah. I was here Wednesday night. I saw that happen, as a matter of fact. The old community meetings. Okay. But the idea of that is that it's a place and a time. It's a place and a time to feelings to be heard and things to be negotiated. Because the one thing that is a constant rule is that whatever has been negotiated can be renegotiated. That's why you make things time limited. You try it out because you think this is the most appropriate way, but if you find out that it's causing more havoc and chaos than it's causing peace and harmony, then it's time to change the rules, you know. But the idea is that it's important to be renegotiated. And the key to family meetings is not only do we redefine rules or boundaries, we redefine rules and boundaries, but it's also a time to vent feelings. In other words, one of the good things that's important is that, especially in supporting the grief process, is that it's a time of saying, okay, this is a time where we can sit down and talk. And you can say anything that you need to say without having a consequence for it. In other words, you can set out a period of time to say, I hate you, I think this sucks, you know, this is unfair, I think you're doing this, you're a hypocrite, you know. That you give children permission to say whatever they want as long as they understand, you know, and you will sit and listen as long as they understand that you get to say anything you want. And you know, and they will sit and listen. And the key to that is that you don't become abusive in that time, but it becomes a time of venting feelings. So that you get a consistent time where the family can really share their sense of unfairness. Because a lot of times if there are multiple kids in the family, for example, that they might have lots of resentments about each other, such and so as being treated unfairly, or they get more than I get, or you know, I think you guys spoil such and so, and it, you know, and it's real important for them because many times they just need to pour it out of their system. And if they know that there is a time and a place that they have permission to do that. Our kids, you know, they're always complaining every time we call a family meeting, but the idea is, and what I watch is that when we do that, they go up and they turn off the TV. And they all gather, get their little spot somewhere around the family room, and they sit down. And so it's like, while they're bitching and moaning, they're all saying, yeah, I'm ready. You know, so you watch for that kind of behavior, because that's really important. And that eventually when they know that they are feeling heard, and they see results coming out of that, like if you can hear what they have to say and say, yeah, I really hear that. I never thought about that, but you're really right. And that becomes a part of the negotiation. What family meetings do is provide a sense of empowerment, that they are validated and respected as a part of the family itself. You still have the responsibility as a parent, ultimately, to set the final rule and to dole out the consequences, but if their input is respected.
I'm just curious about to know a little bit about what happens in this family meeting, because the whole concept just kind of boggles my mind. And when we talk about trying to do that kind of stuff here at home as adults, and we, you know, look at the end square one, I mean, how do you do it? I mean, one-on-one is one thing, but as a group, as a family unit,
well, as a group, it's the same thing. It's a time where we challenge each other, we confront each other about behaviors that we've seen going on. Maybe there have been behaviors about that they haven't been serious enough to warrant any consequences, but we may have lots of feelings about them. For example, we had one the other day where our 12-year-old, you know, he's been real agitated all week, and he hadn't really broken any major rules, so there weren't any consequences, but everybody had lots of feelings. They were all mad because he was mad all week, and he was really, and so we had a family meeting, sat down, and we just started talking about it. Everybody had a chance to say, you know, even the 7-year-old says, yeah, Jason is doing this to me, and he didn't do that, you know, and he made me go to my room, and I didn't do anything to deserve it, you know, And we had recognized that he was really short and didn't do well in some of his other things. And as we just shared that concern with him, ultimately he broke out in tears. And a part of it was that he is angry at his real dad, because his real dad had just sent some money down to the older girl for a prom dress thing. And he was feeling really rejected and abandoned because his real dad has never done anything like that for him. See, and the older gal in our family is a real manipulator. She really plays, you know, her mom and dad's separation, and plays them one against the other, so, and plays their guilt. And so she gets a lot of things, whereas Jason, the 12-year-old, has a tendency not to be, Jason is not as assertive. You know, he tends to be much more passive and doesn't ask for what he needs. So he's real jealous of the older gal, because he has the same wants and desires, but he's not clear in going out to do that. And so he's got all of this stuff inside. And Bridget was running around all excited about getting $50 from her dad to go buy this dress so that she could go to this prom. And Jason was walking around agitated all week. And there's no way we would have had an opportunity to do that unless we had had a family meeting where people were saying, well, it's obvious there's something going on. And what happens is that if you do this on a consistent basis, what it does is it avoids the massive accumulations and the explosiveness, that you're able to check in with each other and challenge each other on a more consistent basis. And it's many times at those family meetings that a lot of the old rules that have been established that you get a chance to renegotiate. Because sometimes the kids will say, you know, well, we've been doing that for a long time and I don't deserve that. You know, I want to renegotiate that. You know, we had a thing last summer where they wanted to renegotiate their allowance because for years they've been only receiving a certain amount of money and they wanted a lot more money. So I says, well, I'd be willing to consider that, but what are you willing to do for all of this money that you want in your life? So we renegotiated that they get a lot of money, but they are responsible to buy all their own clothes, to do all their own activities. So that there were other responsibilities around the house that they used to get paid for that they're no longer getting paid for. You know, that these are just, now they are not questioned, and if they choose not to do those things, they choose not to get their allowance. You know, so there are lots of ways to renegotiate, because as they go through their development, their needs change, their feelings change, and that these family meetings become an important time. And it's the same thing here at Holden. I mean, part of what I heard you going through the other night is a real family phenomenon. How do we do Eucharist? You know, the passing of the cup. And a part of it is that it can be real serious, and you begin to experience some of the division or the grief in the community. On the other hand, you're able to support each other with levity and light. And, you know, I mean, I like the idea of the letters cut out and pasted on the pages. I know. I mean, those kind of, see, it's a way that you are able to balance each other out. It's both serious, but we can enjoy each other in the process. But we're still involved in a communal decision-making process. And that's a validation.